Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniels, Tennessee Honey, and Cope Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hello and welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer, your co-host. On the line, Max Linsky. Evan Ratliff is another co-host, though he is not here for this intro. Hello, Max.
How are you, sir? It is good to see you. Evan is doing his, you know, investigative reporting thing. But Aaron, you're doing the interview thing. Who is on the show this week?
On the show this week, I talked to Alexandra Lang. She is a design and architecture critic. I enjoyed her work very much at Design Observer. She was at Curbed. And she has a book out now. It's called Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. It is exactly what it sounds like, a deeply researched history of the rise and fall and, dare I say, potential rebirth of American mall industry.
Malls are coming back?
We don't give spoilers in the intro. But, you know, I don't know a ton about architecture. I know next to nothing about architecture criticism. As far as I know, she's the first person who we've had on the show who writes about this topic. And one of the things I wanted to talk to her about is that generally when you read about architecture, you're reading about some ascendant prize-winning architect. And what she's writing about in terms of the history of the mall is architecture from a very different perspective. So that's the interview. We are brought to you, of course, in partnership with Vox, who help us produce the show. Thanks to everyone at Vox.
Now here is Aaron with Alexandra Lang.
Welcome to the Long Form Podcast, Alexandra Lang.
Thank you.
You have a new book out. It is about the American mall. I guess it's about, are there international malls in it also, or is it only on the American mall?
The conclusion is about international malls. And honestly, like, I have a lot of international followers who are like, are you writing about malls in Eastern Europe? Are you writing about malls in the UK? Blah, blah. And I was like, you know, I think you should do that book because I feel comfortable here in the US.
I do feel like it's difficult. Like, a lot of the book is about the competing feelings of like nostalgia and destruction. I don't know if that's an international phenomenon. Like, I don't know in Eastern Europe if people have these kinds of deep emotional connections to their malls.
They do, actually, but each country or region has a really different trajectory in terms of how the malls developed. And in a lot of places, they were always more urban. In a lot of places, they always had more public facilities. So I just feel like you really have to understand the larger, like, cultural construct of the mall in the individual country. And that's like in the conclusion where I talk about some of that sort of alternate mall history. I quote a lot of, you know, people, critics and historians from other countries, because I'm just like, yeah, they get it in a way that I would never get it.
So For you, when you're bringing to life malls, where do you find the balance between describing like the physical structure and everything else that goes along with understanding something like a mall?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing for me is that I actually find it very easy to describe things. Like, I'm just like a fundamentally visually driven person. So describing things comes really naturally. And I also have a very kind of vivid, almost cinematic, I would say, imagination. So reading about these older malls, I feel very able and capable to kind of like put myself into that space and understand what people would have been seeing and what they were wowed by. I mean, I think that's why, I mean, I don't know if it's why I became an architecture critic, but I think that's why I'm a good architecture critic, because that's how my mind works. And so the trickier part is to try to get people whose minds don't work that way to, you know, first of all, read architecture criticism at all, and then to like get into the space with me.
Yeah, I think I don't have a visual system inside my brain. So for someone who to whom this idea is alien, what details do you find resonate with people? What are the ways that you can compress a whole building into a limited word count?
Well, I think this is something that I've told my students a lot. Like, the easiest way to get people into an imaginary building, let's say, or, you know, a historic building, is just to do it as if you were having that pedestrian entrance experience. So to go into a mall, I would say, you know, talk about the parking lot, talk about what the entrance canopy looks like, the pavement under your feet, because in fact, there's so much kind of pavement and floor in a mall, and what the material of that is like makes a huge difference in how you're kind of reading the aesthetic. Go down that long hall and then you see a fountain. You know, that's the title of my book. So what does that fountain look like? Is it pretty? Is it sparkly? Is there light coming down? So just to describe that coming in, seeing the kind of main event of the mall, and then going off in whatever direction to the department store, to the food court, you know, to the bookstore, I think is the easiest way. And you can do that for any building. Like, you're trying to figure out like what the architect wanted you to do, and then describe that feeling in like a physical and grounded way for your reader.
How do you think about the relationship of the building being a success on its own terms or based on the objectives of the people building it versus your own subjective opinions on whether it's beautiful or not? Like, what are the merits on which you are evaluating a physical structure?
Well, I think for me, the first question is like, is it working? Like, I want to know what the architect thinks, not because I think they're the be all and end all opinion of the building, but just as a kind of baseline, like, can I understand what they were doing? And then I want to evaluate, is it working on their terms? And then I want to evaluate, is it working for me as a semi-ordinary person just walking through it? Like, I try to always remind people that, you know, sometimes you're seeing a new building like as a tour with an architect, but more often, and I think it's much better to just, you know, show up one day and go yourself. And it's like, okay, I'm just a regular person going to this mall for the first time, going to this museum for the first time. And like, is it working for me? Is it hard to open the door? Is there a lot of like security clutter in the front hall that, you know, the architect didn't want there, but in fact, like, that is totally shaping my experience of entering the building, you know, and so on from there. So, I mean, I think beauty is really important, but more and more, I think that is a secondary characteristic to how me and a lot of other architects are evaluating buildings. Like, we really want them to function at a deeper level and for more different kinds of people. And I think you just kind of add layers of awareness. Like, now, obviously, there's been more talk about how buildings serve people with disabilities. So if you have designed your building with a big, important set of steps at the entrance, and that's clearly the way the architect wants you to enter, that's problematic because a lot of people won't be able to take those steps. And are they shunted over to the side? Like, just because I can walk up the steps doesn't mean I shouldn't evaluate the other ways of getting into the building.
As you get into more avant-garde and showpiece architecture, do the same kinds of values hold true?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think architecture has got to work. Like, that's one of the things that makes it different than art. And sometimes I get really frustrated with artworks that look like architecture, but like don't have to have the same like functional capabilities as architecture. So yeah, I mean, no matter how avant-garde you get, if you can't find the entrance to the building, that is a problem. But I also need to note, just because you mentioned the architect's profiles being like the way that most people, I think, encounter architecture in mainstream magazines, I wrote a piece a couple years ago called like The End of the Architect Profile, and I don't write architect's profiles anymore because I really think that is a bad way to portray architecture. Because most architecture is not done by one person, and it shouldn't be evaluated on a masterwork basis. We shouldn't only be interested in these architects who are already famous doing, you know, like more big name buildings, and never think about all the people working for them, and never think about the more ordinary architectures that people are more likely to encounter. I mean, that's really one of the reasons I wanted to write about malls, which have in fact been designed by some Pritzker Prize winning architects, but like people are much more likely to have been to a mall than they are to have necessarily been to an airport or a museum or, you know, all of these other like types of architecture.
Thinking of that sort of rejection of the auteur theory of Pritzker winning architecture, this book still does have a lot of biographical detail about the people who built the malls. So when you are going into those histories, what is important about the people who design structures to you and their personal lives?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely thought about that, and I talked about it a lot with my book editor at Bloomsbury, Ben Hyman. I mean, he felt like it was really important for readers to have a few people to kind of hang on to. And so Gruen is a really obvious one, and he has a fairly spectacular biography. I actually struggled a lot with that chapter because I think he's the, let's say, mall maestro that has had the most written and done by it. Like, he was the most known figure already. And so I had to kind of pick my way through his memoir and some of the other biographies of him to try to figure out which narrative about him I wanted to tell and kind of which points of emphasis I wanted to make. I mean, I think the privilege of being a critic is that you can pick and choose. Like, I would never write a biography of someone because obviously you're still picking and choosing, but you do have to have this whole sweeping chronology and, you know, talk about their childhood and stuff like that. And I don't find myself so interested in that. But like with Gruen, it was interesting to me that he worked on the GM Futurama, which is this very famous, you know, pavilion at the 1939 World's Fair that set out to show the world in 1960. So like, obviously, you know, like from a design point of view, obviously that was a formative experience in his biography. So I feel like I had the option of emphasizing that rather than some other things about him, because I felt like you could draw kind of a design biography that was more compressed. And I also was at pains to credit his first wife, Elsie Crummick, who did a lot of the original New York City boutiques with him. So like, that's another way to try to complicate this story. Say like, hey, you know, he had a collaborator who was actually a woman on a lot of this early work that made his name. And she's not always mentioned more recently, but, you know, traditionally not always mentioned.
Buildings don't necessarily have such a neat beginning, middle, and end. And if they do, it's played out over 100 years sometimes. So how do you think of structure in terms of how you turn this story into a book?
Well, it actually, I mean, this book grew out of a few articles that I wrote for Curbed when I was the architecture critic there. And really, the first article I wrote about malls for Curbed was in 2018. And it was the mall isn't really dead. We're just calling it different things now sort of story. So I would say that like my premise from the beginning was like, yes, there is this huge popular narrative that malls are dead. And a lot of people that I talked to about this book was like, oh, are you writing about dead malls? And I was just like, you know, I would never spend 2 years of my life writing about something that was dead. Like that is just not my attitude. Like, that's not a fun book. Like, I don't think people, I think people want to look at those pictures, but I don't think they want to read like a narrative that ends like in the end, like the mall is over. But so my premise was always some malls are dying. Yes. But we in America, you know, people are still designing and building things that look like malls, that act like malls, that have this narrative of malls. So maybe it's time to remind people that there is this much longer mall narrative of malls, that malls have a history, and that malls like haven't always been the same, that like they have periods just like any historical form of architecture, and that there have been a lot of deep thoughts about malls. I mean, I think part of my narrative was just like, no, malls aren't dead yet. But also it was like, malls aren't superficial either, right? They can seem like this commercial space. We associate them with teenagers and brands and all these things that are sort of like bright and colorful and fun and a little bit disposable. But not only is the architecture not disposable, but like those feelings that we have about them aren't disposable either.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Vox Creative.
This is advertiser content from 26.2 Team Milk and their new docuseries, Running Sucks.
Is running the worst?
Yeah.
Do you love it? Do you hate it?
I hate it so much. I hate it so freaking much.
That you're a real runner now!
I hate it.
I'm Abby Ayers, a 37-year-old mom from Utah who found herself running across the Manhattan Bridge in my first race ever.
Running Sucks celebrates women who run and the running communities that carry them across the finish line.
Running helped me in so many ways postpartum.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
For every person like you, I'm telling you, you belong, and I'm telling you, you can do it.
I never thought the words would leave my mouth, but yes, I'm planning on running a marathon. I can't even say it without laughing, because, like, who would have thought?
Watch Running Sucks at runningsucktheseries.com and learn more about how Team Milk is helping women runners across the country conquer their next course.
What were your, like, research techniques? Like, how do you get into these things that were kind of like blips in the local paper at the time? How do you go about that?
Well, there are a lot of great, mostly on Blogspot, actually, there are a lot of great mall blogs that I feel like have done a lot of the research work for me, or at least like the preliminary research. There are also a fair number of videos on YouTube about mall openings, especially, you know, scenes from the mall opening filmed by the local TV station. That's how I know that at, say, Owings Mills, they had this shower of feathers, you know, coming down from the ceiling of the atrium when it opened. And I guess, yeah, like one thing I'm trying to do is like make people feel that excitement to see these as like a civic moment, because I don't think, you know, malls are that way in our imagination now. And then I did read a lot of articles in local papers. I mean, like, one of the blessings of the digital revolution is that I was able to do a lot of the research for this book, you know, at my computer, at home, like via NYPL databases, via like various newspaper databases, these mall blogs, you know, which are basically amateur historians. Like, all of that was very present and helpful, and like I could just get it from my computer.
When malls were in their full swing at the peak of the American mall, was there a lot of criticism written? Like, were you able to draw on other critics in putting together the book?
Yes and no. You know, one of the things I found out was that Jane Jacobs actually went out and reviewed Southdale, Victor Gruen's first indoor mall, you know, as if it was this main event. So like, that's really fun. Everybody who's heard of Jane Jacobs is like, okay, so Jane Jacobs thought the mall was super important. There's another critic named Grady Clay, who was more of a regional critic, and he also covered malls. But then, like, I would say at the top echelons of criticism, there was a lot of negative energy towards malls. Basically, my two greatest, like, architecture critic heroes, Ada Louise Huxtable and Michael Sorkin, hated malls. And my epigraph is from Ada Louise Huxtable, and it's kind of a joke because it's a very dismissive quote from a story that she wrote in 1976 about malls. So I just put it in there to kind of say, like, this is what I'm fighting against. Like, I love these people. They were great critics, but I think they were wrong about like what malls would ultimately come to mean.
How did you become a architecture critic? What led you here?
So I'm like the third generation in a design family. So I was always like oriented towards design. We had a lot of modern design in my house. That was just like kind of a dialogue that like came very naturally to me. And I started getting interested in architecture when I was like 12 or 13. And I took a class at the local community center, and my mom actually gave me a book of Ada Louise Huxtable's criticism in high school. So I had the idea of a critic in the back of my mind. And then in college, I was like a double major in literature and architecture, and I was an arts editor at the school paper. So I was basically, I mean, you can make all of these narratives sound super smooth, like I, you know, this was destiny, blah, blah. And it wasn't like that at all. But I was always simultaneously interested in writing and architecture. And when I got out of college, I got a job as an editorial assistant at New York Magazine. And that's what really taught me about feature writing, which I sort of do on and off. But I think that my criticism is fairly featurey. Like, I like a scene, I like a walk around, all of these kind of techniques. And that definitely comes from my time working at New York Magazine. After I worked at New York Magazine for about 5 years, I went back to school and got a PhD in architecture history. And I was still freelancing during that time, you know, for money. And after that, I just started to specialize more in writing for architecture and design publications, and to try to kind of narrow my focus so that I would be, you know, seen as a specialist. I could write more opinionated things than I had been. But I actually think, you know, I've been working in journalism since 1994, and I've been a freelancer since 1998. So like, there have been a lot of pivots in that time. And I feel like the most decisive one was in 2009, after the recession, like all the freelancing just dried up. Like, all of these places that I'd been writing for regularly, like, were like, no, we're just going to do it in-house. And at that point, I started my own blog on Tumblr. And you know, I cringe reading some of the things that I wrote, but it was much more free form. Like, I would just write about movies that had a design content. Like, I let myself try to be a blogger and like get rid of some of the institutional voice that I developed. And that was really good because that really helped me develop my voice and the way that I think that I write now that's distinctive. And then that blog led me to like kind of a paid blogging position at Design Observer, a super influential design blog. And then that led to an opinion column at Dazine. And then that led to the architecture critic job at Curb. So basically, like, internet publishing has been very good to me. Like, I rarely appear in print. But starting that blog and thinking about how do I want to sound and like letting myself be more casual was really important, I think.
You have these concepts in architecture and in criticism of what people should do and what they did do. The should is in the public good, it's sustainability, it's public spaces that are accessible to all. And those are all one form of ideal. And then there's different ideals for like the people who are putting up the money for the mall, which are like bringing in customers, selling stuff, not spending too much building the mall. How do you think about those sorts of trade-offs and the difference between what people should do based on certain ideals and like the practical realities of building buildings?
I don't actually believe that better materials are always better. I mean, if you look at contemporary mall design, there's a lot of marble, a lot of shiny marble. And all the malls I like the one I talk about in my second chapter, North Park, has polished concrete floors and white brick walls. And it's so much nicer than these kind of alienating, super shiny, super hard marble spaces like at American Dream and some other, malls, like part of Mall of America has been remodeled and it looks very similar. And if you look at photos of those spaces, they all look alike and they are not warm and they are not human in the same way that something like brick and concrete can be. So I think really in all architecture, it's all in the way you deploy the materials. It's not about the expense of the material. The other part of your question, I agree all of those things should be public goods. Like the public domain should provide clean bathrooms and air conditioning and like lots of comfortable seating, but it is not doing it. It's certainly not doing it in New York City where there are no benches in Moynihan Station. And it's just not doing it in general. And the malls by and large are. And we have to look at people who are interested in like the future of architecture and urbanism have to look at the places that people actually like to go and what those places are surviving. Like there's no point in just standing back and only talking about these idealized spaces. I think most critics, like we want to be active. We want to talk about what people like, what they're doing. And one of those spaces is malls.
The buildings that you write about have these long lives that they are evolving. Malls are an evolving art form. And how do you think about the lifespan of architectural stuff? And do you feel like there's like an ideal time to be writing about it?
Well, the nerdy term for it is post-occupancy review. Because of the way the media cycle is, like most mainstream media only wants to hear about a building the minute it's opened. It's kind of like those architect profiles. Like architects get profiled when a big skyscraper is about to open in a major city, even if that's not their most interesting work. A new building gets profiled the minute it opens, when in fact we have the least amount of information about it from a kind of humanist point of view. So there have been various experiments over the years. Actually, Witold Rybczynski for a while was writing this column for Architect Magazine where he would go back and look at a building, like 10 years after it had opened. And I thought that was great. Like, all of us would be down for that, but that's not what editors want. There's always like a little bit of market forces at work. The interesting thing for malls was that often when I was trying to research a new mall, like the best first source of information was actually Wikipedia, because Wikipedia stays up to date. So if I was trying to figure out like how many different owners a mall had had or how many times it had been added onto, it was the Wikipedia that would then link me to those local paper articles about all the changes in the mall. And, one of the things that I kind of used historical research for was to establish what the mall looked like at the beginning. But then sometimes the ways a place like the Mall of America has changed, like what you're actually seeing is fashion imprinting itself on the architecture of the mall. And because the mall sells fashion, I think it's honestly easier to talk about the changing looks of a mall than it is to talk about the changing looks of some other building types.
This week on The Pitch, would you like fries with that?
People are what make franchises run. The person who knows the business inside and out. Yeah. Yep. Not someone who came off Wall Street because their check clears. Franchairs is the first investment marketplace where people can invest in franchises.
So you said $800 billion is what this market is a year. And hundreds of businesses are actually franchised businesses.
Thousands.
Thousands and thousands.
There are more brands franchised than there are stocks on the NASDAQ.
Oh.
You're raising a $4 million price round.
And what are the terms on that?
The $19 million post-money valuation.
And you, do you not think that the valuation is a little frothy?
This week, things get frothy when Kenny Rose brings a new alternative investment class to retail investors. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch, wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you zoomed out on America, or really most countries, and you looked at like where all the wealth is, it's mostly in real estate. And yet there aren't a ton of people who write about the thing that most of our money is in, which is in buildings, basically. Why do you think that is? Why are we not more interested in a society in this thing that we're perfectly willing putting our entire net worths into?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of real estate writing, but it's like mostly about the money part of it. And, you know, I don't think, you know, the people that are making the money are that interested in criticism. I mean, the big mall companies wouldn't talk to me for this book. Like, I read a lot of articles. I read lots of business journalism where they did talk to them. And I just kind of used my own alternate research techniques. But I feel like that's the attitude a lot of times. Like, they don't need me and, you know, twerpy little people like me writing about them. So why would they contribute, like agree to interviews, et cetera? Like, it's not necessary. But I also think, I mean, I don't know. Why don't more people read architecture criticism? Like, this is like something that I struggle with all the time, because it's like, I think I'm entertaining. Like, I am like very connected to the world. Like, I think if you read my stuff, you'll get it. But I feel like there's just this sense that architecture criticism is boring. And I don't know who gave people that sense, but there's just kind of a barrier, not, I think, to the actual material, but just to even bothering to read it. But for me, like, I really like to write about things that, like, I can hold an experience. Like I said earlier, like, I'm not that interested in biography, but I am very interested in the biography of an object. And again, like, you know, this is something my editor and I had a lot of back and forth about. Like, he wanted me to write more about people. And I'm like, but I love objects. Like, I feel about the objects, I think, how most people feel about people. So, like, what I'm always trying to do is kind of communicate that enthusiasm and that understanding to my reader, because these objects really have a lot of speaking to do. And I think ultimately it's easier to connect if people have their own physical experiences in the objects. I mean, the best example of this is my last book was called The Design of Childhood. And it was about all the ways in which design interacts with children's lives, especially like in the first 12 years. And the most popular chapter of that book is on playgrounds. And I think it's because everyone's been to a playground, you've seen a playground. So then I think that kind of softens you up to be willing to, like, let me tell you about the whole history of playgrounds. I mean, I feel like that's a great analogy for the mall book. It's like, you've been to a mall, but did you know that, like, malls have this whole complicated history, that they have periods, that they have actually multiple innovators? Like, I feel like you should want to know about that.
When you're writing about a niche that's like really, really alive and present for you, but for other people, they're like, tell me the stories of the people behind it, or why is that interesting? Like, how do you sell other people on writing about this thing that, like, isn't part of the general magazine and lit writing cycle?
Well, do you want to know what I led my book proposal for this book with?
Please, please.
Stranger Things.
There you go.
That's how you sell it. Like, sorry, but that's how you sell it. You say, I'm interested in this thing. Like, I think that I have pretty good kind of cultural antennae and news judgment. I think other people are interested in malls. Like, we're at a place with malls. But, like, how do I prove to book editors that are, again, you know, general interest, that malls are interesting? I'm like, what's like the biggest TV hit of this year? And like, where is it set? And like, when were the Duffer Brothers born? Oh, like, that's my target audience. Like, 80s babies like the Duffer Brothers who like want to go back to this place where they discovered the mall, where it was this place of freedom. You know, there's that whole great fashion sequence where, you know, Eleven gets a makeover. Like, that is a classic 80s, 90s movie scene that they've put in this show that came out this year, or, you know, the year I was writing my book proposal. So yeah, I basically used other pop culture, other more popular pop culture as proof.
It's interesting. Like, I was asking when the ideal time to write about something is, and I feel like it is the right time to write about malls. It's not because of Stranger Things, but it's almost like it being malls time is working on the same like pop cultural life. Are we in a like 1980s like cultural cycle right now? Is that the right amount of time?
Okay. Yes, that is absolutely what's happening. And like, yes.
So what's next? Like, what would the next thing that we're going to pass in the canal of time? I guess the 90s.
Yeah, but the 90s is bad. I mean, the 90s is really problematic. Well, for architecture, like the 90s is the architecture that a lot of architecture firms suppress on their website. So what do I think is next? I mean, probably like millennium Y2K nostalgia. I don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I was already an adult with my own taste at that time. So it's a little different. Like, for me, like, I went through the 80s malls as, you know, a teenager and teen, just kind of experiencing it without the layer of kind of critical distance. So I'd say that is where it is. I mean, like, one of the things that flagged me that like the 80s was now history was not just Stranger Things, but also looking at what people were interested in terms of architecture history, like where the academics were doing research. Because when I wrote my dissertation in the early 2000s, it was about post-war architecture. And that was still like a growing field. But at this point, like, post-war architecture is over. Like, people have been over and over and over it. And I was seeing many more like dissertations and publications writing about the 70s and 80s, you know, postmodernism was back. So that, you know, like, it happens differently in every field, but it can be an indicator of just like that we are as a culture ready to look at something through the lens of history.
What's next for you? Do you have projects already planned? I guess it's unfair. Your book came out this week. I should give you like at least 6 months before I ask you to answer that question.
Yeah, I'm not one of those magical people that has already sold their next book. I think what I'm interested in right now is doing some work that is not writing a giant book and maybe not even writing criticism. Like, one of the projects that I took up this year, kind of like while I was in book edits, was I'm editorial advisor to a podcast about women architects called New Angle Voice. And we launched our first season this spring, and it's done really well. We have like 30,000 downloads of these profiles of five deceased women architects, which I think is pretty amazing. So we'd really like to do a second season of that. So that's something I'll be working on in the fall. I'm going to be teaching next spring a criticism class. So yeah, I'm trying to kind of skip around for projects that use a different energy than writing a book. And I'm hoping by doing that, that some new ideas about my next book will start to germinate.
Well, thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you.
Hey, Thanks for listening to the Long Form Podcast. I'm your co-host, Aaron Lammer. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thanks to our editor on this episode, Jackie Sajiko. Thanks to our intern, Susan Peterson. Thanks to everyone over at Vox Media. Oh, thanks to my guest, Alexandra Lang. Thanks to you for listening. If you're enjoying the show, consider reviewing and rating it. That seems like a good thing to do. We'll be back next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.